If you get your child vaccinated for chickenpox, should you worry?
Do people with heart disease and anemia need treatment?
Overcoming a reduction in the blood supply to the heart.
And is there a healthy obese?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on December 6th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, I'm going to reveal to our listeners that we had a rather pointed discussion before we started recording on the chickenpox vaccine and the shingles vaccine. I erroneously made the statement that adults were recommended to get this vaccine when they were 55, and you said, no, it's 60, and you were right. But now let's turn to the pediatric age group and see if we get our children vaccinated for chickenpox, does that put us as adults at risk for developing shingles?
Well, Elizabeth, I'm going to both gloat and give you credit for admitting I was right on air to our tens of thousands of listeners. So thank you. Back to the study. In the United States, adults, about 90% of them have been exposed to chickenpox. Even though the chickenpox skin rash resolves, the virus continues to live in the nerves. Later on in adulthood, the virus could become reactivated and cause a very painful skin condition called shingles. Because somewhere between 1 in 8 and 1 in 4 individuals that live to be age 65 will have it before they die, the recommendation is to get the shingles vaccination. Part of the concern is, well, gosh, now that we're vaccinating our children, does that decrease exposure of adults to chickenpox and decrease their immunity and therefore make them at a higher risk for developing shingles? The purpose of this study was to address that. They did a retrospective study of Medicare claims looking at almost 3 million beneficiaries over the age of 65. There were over 250,000 incidences of zoster, and also asked whether the introduction of the vaccine in 1996 increased the risk of zoster. Here's what they found. From 1992 to 2010, there was clearly an increase in the risk of zoster. It went up about 39%, but it wasn't tied at all to the vaccination of children. In fact, that increase began in 1992, continued through 1996 before the immunization was recommended for the children, and then it continued at the same rate up to 2010.
Well, okay, but why are we seeing an increased rate of shingles?
Unfortunately, this study didn't address it. And not only that, the authors admit we just really don't know why that is. They say we have no explanation for the trend. That's pretty unusual for doctors to admit they don't know something.
Very good. So I guess I would just say that I can recall a pretty eloquent study I was familiar with on people who had had shingles and subsequently developed depression, pretty severe depression, because the condition can be so very, very painful and debilitating and long lasting. So I guess I would offer the public health message that, hey, if you're 60 or older, you really ought to go in there and get that shingles vaccine.
And let me put up an exclamation point specifically. 86% of eligible adults recommended to have the vaccine aren't getting it.
Okay. We have quite a few studies we're talking about this week from Annals. Let's just move forward into the next one. And this is this really great study, I think, of the fitness versus the fatness myth. We, of course, have talked in the last few years about whether people who are overweight or, in fact, obese, but who are also cardiovascularly in pretty good shape and do a lot of exercise, are those folks overcoming the deleterious health impact of being fat?
A normal size based upon BMI would be a BMI of less than 25. People that are overweight have a BMI of 25 to 30, and people that are obese have a BMI of over 30. Obesity is associated with an increased risk of mortality and cardiovascular disease. So the real question is the excess cardiovascular morbidity and mortality from obesity due to the metabolic syndrome, or is obesity completely by itself, independent of that, also associated with an increased risk? This study looked at electronic databases, studies that identified people that were either normal, overweight, or obese, and secondly, whether they were metabolically healthy or unhealthy. Does obesity itself increase your risk? And the answer to that is yes. It increased the risk for having cardiovascular events by about 24%. What does metabolic syndrome add to that? Well, it tends to triple the risk of cardiovascular events, and it triples it for people that are normal weight, overweight, and it triples it for people that are obese as well. And what that means is there's no such thing as a healthy pattern of being overweight.
And of course, we talk about this so very many times. We know that there's also a constellation of other things that affect people who are overweight, such as osteoarthritis of the knee, increased back problems. Mortality aside, even looking at quality of life while you're on this planet is also negatively impacted by obesity.
The point's well taken, Elizabeth. And those manifestations you mentioned are immediate. The manifestations related to cardiovascular disease don't make themselves evident until 10 years down the road. And that's part of the reason why we weren't really sure whether obesity was associated with increased risk or not. Many studies were short-term studies, and as you mentioned, they showed a decreased quality of life, but not a decreased quantity of life.
Okay, yet one more reason to, I think, resolve not to eat too much over the holidays and also maybe turn over that New Year's resolution about maintaining or reducing weight. Since we're talking about causes of mortality, our last two studies for this week are going to focus on cardiovascular disease, the number one killer, of course. One of those is in Annals, the other in JAMA Internal Medicine. Why don't we take a look at that one first, this idea of ischemia? How do we treat reduced blood flow to the heart?
As you mentioned, worldwide, coronary artery disease is the leading cause of death. If you have coronary artery disease, one in 30 patients with stable disease experiences cardiovascular death or MI, heart attack, each year. We can predict who's at higher risk, and we do that by looking for ischemia, that is insufficient blood flow to the heart. And the people that have any abnormalities are at increased risk of death or heart attack. One might presume that if you relieve that ischemia, you could prevent death or heart attack. And that was the essence of this study. It was a meta-analysis of all the randomized controlled trials asking if we take people that have myocardial ischemia and we put half of them on just good medical therapy and the other half we put on good medical therapy and we put a drug-eluting stent in, can we decrease the risk of heart attacks or death with the stent? Elizabeth, would taking those high-risk individuals and relieving the ischemia prevent those cardiovascular events?
I'm going to say no.
You're absolutely right. It is absolutely counterintuitive to what many individuals as patients believe and the way that many cardiologists practice as well. There were five trials that enrolled almost 5,300 patients. Those that were randomized to good medical therapy did just as well as those who had percutaneous coronary intervention. No decreased risk of death with stenting, no decreased risk of heart attack, of angina as well.
And I would say an increased risk of restenosis, probably. Of course, I had to add that one. I'm not surprised at all by this, Rick. I mean, we have talked about this very good optimized medical therapy for this particular condition before and seen its benefit.
Although the optimized medical therapy clearly has benefits, there's no doubt, it doesn't relieve ischemia. What kills individuals with coronary disease is a sudden heart attack. And those heart attacks oftentimes occur in blood vessels that don't have the most significant stenosis, the one we put a stent in. Oftentimes they're in blood vessels that have minimal coronary disease. This means it's a paradigm shift. Taking people with myocardial ischemia and recommending them to have a stent, we'd stop doing it. There's an ongoing study right now called the ischemia trial of over 8,000 patients randomized to good medical therapy or percutaneous coronary intervention. So we'll have that answer in several years.
Outstanding. Okay, finally then, let's go back to Annals of Internal Medicine and talk about anemia in heart disease and whether treating anemia helps.
About one-third of patients that have congestive heart failure are anemic, and somewhere between 10 and 20% of patients that have coronary disease, blockages in their arteries, are anemic as well. It's always been a dilemma of how do you treat patients that are anemic and have heart disease. And there have been three different ways these patients have been approached. One is to transfuse them. The second is we can oftentimes give them medications. These are erythropoiesis-stimulating agents. Or the third is just to give iron. So this is a report from the American College of Physicians who developed guidelines based upon their review of all the published literature from 1947 to 2013. In all the studies they examined, the administration of transfusions for people with mild to moderate anemia did not improve cardiovascular outcome. Well, what about just giving EPO? That wasn't helpful either. In fact, that was associated with an increased risk of clots and strokes. And the last issue is with regard to iron. What the American College of Physicians is recommending is not to give transfusions for people unless they're severely anemic. That's a hemoglobin of less than 7. And certainly to avoid using EPO and to admit that the evidence for iron is still open for discussion.
And again, no surprise, because we've been circling around this for a while. We've talked about erythropoietin in cancer therapies and the multitude of dangers it actually represents. And we've talked about this idea of anemia in the past, too. So I'd have to say, okay, I agree with this. I think we've heard this conclusion before.
Well, but the thing that's important about this is the target population are people that are high risk, trying to lower that by increasing their oxygen carrying capacity. And at least the ways we do it right now aren't helpful and potentially harmful.
Okay, yet one more thing to avoid. On that note then, I have decided, of course, that I'm going to do the fit versus fat myth debunked in the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.